Hello, and welcome to the Learning Mate podcast, where we speak to subject matter experts in the fields of education, education technology, and workforce development to learn more about advances and issues in the industry from cradle to career. I'm your host, Shannon Gattins. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Mitchell Culver, Associate Provost for Engagement and Retention at American Public University System. We will explore the evolving role of AI in higher education, hear about how his passion for education led him to this field, and discuss the paradox instructors and students face today, the risks and rewards of using Gen AI. Welcome, Dr. Culver.
Thanks, Shannon. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So Dr. Culver has been working in higher ed since 2007, and his early experiences with students shaped his belief in the value of human diversity and potential. As a thought leader in education, he frequently advocates for a more intentional approach to student success, one that engages instructors, staff, and institutional leaders alike. So let's get started. So happy to have you here with us, Mitch. I know that you have talked to a couple of our colleagues and they thought that you would be a perfect candidate for a podcast. First of all, you have a lot of experience doing podcasts and your thought leadership is really making a mark on the industry. So thanks again for being here.
Thanks so much, Shannon. Looking forward to this conversation we have.
So I guess the first question is, like, what appealed to you about higher ed as a profession and how did you get into it?
Well, I originally trained in my schooling to be a therapist. And in that period of time, I very much conceived of individualized therapy as a kind of mini educational experience where clients would come in and I never practiced. So in training, you do go and do the hours as a clinical practitioner. And the clients would come in and they would share their experiences. And I had kind of had the impression that things would happen like it does in the movies. Client speaks, they have a problem, they present. And then through some kind of little micro dosing of knowledge or of wisdom, they would improve. But through the practice of learning how to be a therapist, what you realize is actually it's their own talking out loud and they're talking things out that really produces the transformation. It's not micro wisdom that you kind of deposit in their brain. Right. And there was this realization in the program that really, if what I wanted to do was teach people things, I just needed to go and lecture and be a teacher. And so I was on that track to be a lecturer, to be an instructor, and found an opportunity to join a TRIO program with Student Support Services. And for those that don't know, that's a federally funded program that helps marginalized populations really get the most from higher education. And I caught fire in that experience because I was on a regular basis helping students to transition from the concept that college was going to help them to the concept that college was an opportunity for them to transform themselves and become who they were meaning to be in this world, right? So not just college, not just attending college as a consumer, but attending college as a person who could transform. And that kind of led me into a lot of work on human growth and potential, student motivation, and ultimately allowed me to climb up through the institution where data-informed practice became very important. I got into analytics. I got into consulting and helping other people to get the most out of the university environment and to help students get the most out of the university environment. And of course, now I'm associate provost and vice president at a very large online institution. And that progression, I feel, was very natural because every step of the way was about helping students find their growth, find their potential, and really come to terms with the possibilities of their own lives.
That's really interesting. I want to hear a little bit more about APUS, American Public University System. I did just want to say that my son, he's a freshman in college, and I do believe that has been missing in his experience thus far. Understanding that this is a transformative experience beyond the academics and beyond what he is required to do. And I think understanding that you can unleash your full potential during these 4 years is sometimes missed and isn't as intentional. So it's very cool to hear that your focus can really make a huge impact on the outlook of students, to be honest. And it really can motivate them in different ways. So tell me more about APUS. Tell me what your work is there and about what the university offers.
Yeah, so American Public University System is a global digital university. We have nearly 100,000 students in 24 time zones. And most of them are working adults, you know, like 90% of them are working adults. And we actually have some 70,000, 75,000 active duty military service men and women. We are the number one provider of education to active duty service personnel. And I had previously worked in a lot of land grant settings or institutions that were founded to really serve marginalized populations and really bring the promise of higher education to populations that previously didn't have access to it. And I kind of feel like American Public University System, APUS, is in that land grant tradition. We happen to be a private institution, fully online, publicly traded, of our parent company, APEI. And yet in this space and place, I actually find us doing the mission of the liberal arts tradition and the mission of the land grants in a fully online setting, in a setting that really is flexible for those learners. We're very transfer friendly. We have monthly starts to make sure that if people are being deployed or if they have other obligations that are sitting cheek and jowl with their academic obligations, that there's flexibility in the way that they enroll. And so they can start a class and be done 8 weeks later and then take a break and then come back maybe in 5 months and start another class and just have that flexibility that these working adult learners need in order to realize the promise of higher education. And so I feel right at home at this institution and really feel like we are doing such a good service to our large populations of learners around the globe.
That's really impressive. And you know, I hadn't heard about APUS, and I was quite surprised when you had mentioned the number of students. It's like the biggest university you never heard of, right? And what an impact it's having, especially for our active military. So we started out at the top explaining that this episode was going to be around sort of this paradox that we're facing for students and teachers. I don't want to forget our instructors. You know, they're also trying to figure this all out. But I would love to hear from you a little bit more about this paradox, the idea that Gen AI opens so many possibilities, but it's doing something else too. So I'm just going to leave that there. Tell us, you know, your thoughts.
Yeah. So when you think about the rising generation, they are a generation that in their everyday lives, they find technology improving their lived experiences. Whether they're adopting a new app or a new gadget or some new piece of software for their work life or for their academic life, technology typically in their mind equates to life made easy and an improved experience. Gen AI generally falls into that same category of making life easier. But where the paradox arises is when we start looking at an academic setting. Because in an academic setting, the work of the academy is to do the rigor of the academy in an effort to transform yourself, to gain competence, and to become something that you weren't before. You are the product of the institution. And so if we apply that idea that technology should make my life easier, and we apply Gen AI in an academic setting, students are actually in this intuitive paradox where technology is supposed to make things easier, but if you use generative AI to do the heavy lifting of the academy, the rigors of the academy, you actually end up worse off. Now, there's an analogy that's been thrown around, and I think that I subscribe to it, and it's this idea of a gym, where if you were to go to a gym and subscribe and sign up for the monthly fees, and then start showing up and there was this option to push a button and allow the machine to do the lifting, you would immediately see that this is not the goal of having a gym membership. And so it's this evidence of, well, this is stupid. Why would I do this? The whole point is that I can transform through hard work. An academy is an analogy to that, but it has one fundamental difference. And this is what creates the paradox. Students are supposed to show up. They're supposed to do heavy lifting. And then there's this easy button of GPT of, well, I'm just going to have GPT do it. And if they hit that easy button, they don't get the results. But if they can make their way through and not get caught in an academic integrity violation, they get a certificate or a degree, a certification, a transcript at the end of the experience. And that kind of certification where the institution kind of stamps the student with their own imprimatur is not happening at your local gym. Local gyms don't certify the person as athletically fit 4 years later. Universities do certify people as cognitively or disciplinarily fit 4 years later. And so this is where we really run aground. If Gen AI is allowed to operate in institutions and in the hands of students, unchecked, unfettered, and in a degree where they're actually doing more harm to themselves as a result of using Gen AI than just doing the work and doing the work of the institution to improve and transform their own lives.
So when we prepped for this call, I'll be transparent. I think we both acknowledge that each of us could possibly go on a tangent and we would try not to do such a thing. However, I'm grasping onto something you said, and maybe it's because it is personal. Using Gen AI, yes, it can help write papers. It can help students move forward and they get the stamp and then they feel accomplished. I think it goes back to what you said before about students not necessarily viewing their college experience as something that is building them into a new person, right? They're seeing this as a way to get a job or the way to move through the world to be something that they envision for themselves. I guess it really needs to be a change in ideology from the time they step into the university experience in order for them to value the education that they're getting for the transformation it provides rather than the degree that it provides. So
that's exactly right. So my dissertation ended with the conclusion that students' experiences in higher education were going to be best accomplished if institutions would take what's called an ontological view of student development. And ontological just means the nature of existence, or what does it mean to be a student? And unless you teach students, incoming students, what it means to be a learner, they're often very confused about the purposes of an academy. And this is what the goal of the dissertation research was, is can you be successful? If a student, a freshman, is coming into university experience and they don't really understand the liberal arts tradition, like they don't really understand that they're the product and that the point of producing a graduate is to produce a citizen scholar, a person who's well-rounded for the economy, yes, but also well-rounded in the humanities for the sake of contributing to their community. They don't understand that that's the goal. Then they don't get as much from the experience. And the question of my dissertation was, is that so? Can you prove it? How do you model it? And we also replicated the research in London and found the same results, that students kind of come into higher education with one of three ontologies. What does it mean to be a student? In one of those ontologies, the learner views themselves as a learner, a person who's there to participate proactively in the environment, to engage the rigors with a proactive stance, to be critical in their inquiry, to show up socially, and to truly transform as a result of participation. There is a second ontology, which is that students show up as with an investor mindset, that the goal of the education is the certificate or piece of paper, and that there is an investment of time and energy due, but that time and energy invested is not about transformation, but is about an exchange, transactional mm-hmm. rather than transformational. And then there's a third ontology, which is kind of ambivalent, right? They don't know either there. They, They don't know what's going on, but they'll find their way. And the research demonstrated that they do, in fact, find their way. And they usually emerge as either an investor or a learner. The trouble is that when you look at the results of the learner and the results of the investor, they're not the same results. So learners tend to have more motivation for the academic environment, to get better GPAs, to have better retention rates. And in particular, the investors struggle with the general education that they have to pass through, because the investors tended to really see the experience as a transactional one. They just wanted to get right into their major coursework that was job relevant, economy relevant. What are you teaching me that I can take to the market next week, next year? And as soon as you have them, you know, now you have to go read Plato, or now you have to go and study music appreciation. There was frustration. There was a drop in motivation. There was a drop in retention, because they thought, well, here I'm supposed to be doing job training and you're having me listen to a Mendelssohn symphony. Like, what's going on? Right.
Right. Right.
And so these three ontologies, or these three views of what it means to be to exist as a student, really shape the journey that students take through higher education. They can be intervened on. That was the other thing the research showed, is you can actually help a student move from the investor to the learner category. And if you do that, they get a better result. But at the core, it wasn't just teaching them study skills. It wasn't just teaching them about the value of their degree. It was teaching them about the value of conceiving themselves as learners who were there to transform.
So given those three learner types, and maybe we just, or the three types of student, how, because we're really talking about AI, and I do want to bring it back. How, so I can imagine that the investor would use Gen AI as a tool to get around something, whereas a learner would be using Gen AI to facilitate something that they had already conceptualized. So I would love to hear how Gen AI would maybe, in your mind, be used by each of those different student types.
Absolutely. Leaving the ambivalent student aside, because the research really showed that they resolve just through the passage of time. The investor student is much more likely to see the transactional environment as one where the production of the assets or artifacts of learning is the goal. They don't see writing a 10-page paper as a process that helps them to go from not having a lot of thoughts on a topic to doing some research in the stacks of the library and having thoughts, but they're all messy, and then using the writing process to organize one's thoughts in conversation with other authors' thoughts, right? That they don't view that process as the goal. They view the goal as a submission of 10 pages of text. In the era of Gen AI, you can do that with keystrokes, and you can do it in 5 minutes. Mm. And we are having students at institutions across this nation and the globe attempt that. They think that if the goal is to turn in 10 pages of text, I know how to do that with just a few keystrokes.
Mm-hmm.
The learner mindset is more along the lines of looking at it as not only the process, but how am I changing as a result of struggling through not having any thoughts on the 10-page topic, maybe doing some reading and learning what I'm excited about in terms of the authors who have previously spoke about this. And now I have thoughts, but they're messy. And then, of course, the act of writing is an act of organizing one's internal world. And that act of organizing through the catharsis of writing is what really begins to build knowledge, to build the skill sets. And throughout the entire process, there's blood, sweat, and tears, right? There's the blood and sweat and tears of going to the stacks and doing the reading and trying to figure out, finding your bearings in a kind of an ecosystem of other thinkers. And then what do I think? And then the organization act of how do you outline the paper and what point do I want to make? There's blood, sweat, and tears all the way along. We call that rigor. And it is really the work of the academy. And to skip over that doesn't produce what institutions were designed to kind of really catalyze. And so a learner really is going to understand and be a lot more amenable to going through the hard knocks, whereas an investor is going to be like, well, if the GPT can do it with a few keystrokes, what's the harm? And of course, they don't see that they are the product. Their competence is the goal.
It keeps going back to that, which I think is really fascinating. Given that we should, in fact, immediately during freshman orientation, teach the skill or the idea that you are here for transformation, we can put that to the side. Let's think about how we know now the students, both the learners and the investors, are going to use ChatGPT. I mean, they are already using it. What do you do around responsible use? I mean, whose responsibility is it at the university level? Who enforces it? How do you frame it and model it for these students?
I do think that faculty have an opportunity to win students over. This is partly what we showed in that research at Utah State University and in London, was that under the right circumstances, students were perfectly happy to switch their ontological view for a more robust one. You could persuade them. It actually wasn't even that intensive. But in terms of Gen AI, convincing students that they need to use it more responsibly really starts with helping them to value Gen AI for authentic learning. And I think that that is best accomplished by helping them to see how Gen AI can be used in everyday life. And this is a topic I've spoken of at length in different settings and on other podcasts about, are we really helping students to see how Gen AI helps them to answer authentic questions from their everyday life so that they start to get the sense that this tool isn't just a monkey that you can make dance and it will do interesting things, but that it truly is a tool, when used correctly, that can unlock the answers to questions that are authentic in everyday experience. So I'll give you an example of an everyday question. Mm-hmm. I eat a salad every day for lunch, and I had switched up the ingredients from mixed greens to spinach. And that week I was feeling awful in the afternoons, awful. So I went to GPT and I said, hey, I usually have this salad and here's the ingredients and everything that's going on. I switched over to spinach and now I'm feeling awful in the afternoon. What's going on? And it said, absolutely you are, because spinach, unlike other leafy greens, has a lot of oxalates in it. And when you're switching over to that green, that's okay, but your microbiome can't process it very well. And there's a lot of byproducts, and those byproducts are going to mess with your electrolytes. And they're going to leave you probably feeling bloated and fatigued in the late afternoon. Is that how you're feeling? Yeah, that's exactly what's going on. And it said, well, you can kind of get by in this intervening period because your microbiome will eventually catch up and process the spinach really effectively, but you just need to do an electrolyte supplement and then you'll be good. And so that's what I pursued and it worked. And then my microbiome caught up and now I can do spinach every day and there's no problem. It also said, you know, maybe start with just a little bit of spinach and slowly work your way up. So that's really good advice. This was a real life problem that was having real life consequences. I engaged with GPT about it in a thoughtful way because I prompted it in a thoughtful way. And I had experiences learning how to prompt thoughtfully and authentically. I got an answer that was immediately useful and that improved my overall functioning and competence, right? I didn't come away having hit an easy button or stupid button and I'm just having GPT tell me what to do. I came away with a deeper knowledge of how to be more mindful about my nutrition and how to avoid that exact kind of problem from happening in the future. If students don't have these really compelling everyday life, authentic learning examples, they are never going to see GPT as anything more than a dance monkey or easy button or whatever you want to call it, because they will not have had experiences with it where it truly satisfies their cognitive inquiry, that path of learning where you really do have a problem, you really are looking for a solution. And when you get it, there's this sense of, it's called cognitive closure. It's this satisfaction that I did hard work, I worked through a problem, I came to a solution, and putting the solution in place actually improved real world consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they have that notion, they're never going to switch away from it as an easy button.
Yeah. So you've written about how introducing AI into education isn't just a technological shift, really. It's a cultural and psychological shift as well. And that's what I'm hearing you say. So how is the introduction of AI a form of that cultural change? And what are some of the best practices for ensuring that it's successfully integrated really throughout the university ecosystem, whether that's in assignments where the instructors are asking students to use these authentic questions and modeling it for them? I would love to hear your thoughts.
I do think it comes back to ontology and identity, how our students view themselves and how our faculty view themselves. If our students view themselves as learners, they're going to be much more amenable to being told about the pitfalls of the technology and the tools that are available to them. If they only view themselves as degree seekers, as investors, then no matter what intervention you do, it's kind of, you know, stick and slide off. It won't be sticky. And the same is true with faculty. If a faculty only view themselves as the identity of a gatekeeper, right, that they're glorified graders and that really keeping the rigors of the academy by handing out as many Fs and curving all the grades as possible, versus viewing themselves as facilitators of students' well-being, then we're going to be at constant cross purposes. And so I think part of some of the assignments that I've seen at APUS that I really like, one example, and I take no credit for this, I happen to know what's going on, but I certainly didn't design this. It's a beautiful assignment. But one of the English instructors, they have their students take some short story. And I don't know who the author is, so I'm just going to say it's an Edgar Allan Poe short story. And then they have, the assignment is to go to GPT and to give GPT the title of that short story and say, write this short story in the style of Edgar Allan Poe and following a similar plot line with similar characters, but be different, but be the same, you know? So students will have it do that. And then the assignment, at least a portion of the assignment, is to compare the two texts and to ask the student, reading those two short stories, which do you prefer? And the answer is invariably from the students, well, I prefer the great author, right? I don't prefer the GPT. And then to push that line of conversation towards them interrogating, if there is something about Edgar Allan Poe that is truly better, whether that quality is definable or indefinable, why would you want your papers authored by this machine instead of becoming the kind of person who can write a good paper and communicate thoughts effectively and be valued for that aspect or dynamic of your humanity? Students are amenable to that kind of exercise where they come along and go, oh, you're right. And if I'm really the product of the institution, I need to be investing in myself, not investing in words on a page, right? Not investing in easy submission, because submitting an assignment having done no work isn't going to produce the transformation that the institution was designed to catalyze.
So many follow-up questions. But I'm really fascinated by this exercise, particularly because I think it not only illustrates the nuance of creativity, specifically in writing, that you cannot capture through a machine, but it also shows the creativity of the instructor. So what are you seeing? Who is there a category of instructor or faculty that is able to embrace this idea and integrate it more than others? And is there pushback from instructors to embrace it because they feel like it might replace them in the classroom? What is the faculty attitude that you've observed?
In 1962, Everett Rogers published a book called The Diffusion of Innovations. And it's a prophetic work because it really describes how technology proliferates through populations of practitioners. in our case, we have a set of faculty who, just like in the diffusion of innovations model that Rogers defined, are kind of normally distributed. There's a small tail on the end who are early adopters, innovators, champions of thinking ahead. And they're quick on the uptake. Just like with any technology that diffuses through society, you have 5 to 15% of people who are really excited right from the outset and who want the latest and greatest and who are wanting to do the experimentation. Your next 35% before the midpoint of the distribution is called the early majority. They tend only to follow once really good success has been established by those early adopters. Then you have the late majority, which is the next 35% after the midpoint, and they wait for the early majority to adopt. And then Rogers calls the last group laggards, but I like to call them late adopters just because it's less expensive.
Yeah.
And we see this model really, this was the case when I was doing consulting in learning analytics. This was the case at every institution that I worked with. You know, I worked with more than 60 institutions as a consultant on student success analytics. And it was always the case that you would have the small group of pioneers who are really willing to get out there and experiment and do the work of figuring out the highs and lows, the strengths and limitations, the pitfalls. And then other people would kind of come along once there was a clear record of success and kind of a script to follow so that there was more stability in the usage. With generative AI, we see the exact same pattern. It is no different. And there are faculty, and I do still think we have not yet arrived at the early majority, because whatever else higher education is, it's an old growth forest and change comes slow. Even if you set a new game trail in the brush, it takes a long time for people to really say, yeah, I trust that path and I'm going to follow it because I know it's going to lead me to a good end. And so at my institution and at others that I've worked with in the recent past, there is still a great deal of trepidation from the old guard faculty, exactly as you say, of, is this going to replace me? And also, where do I fit into this? Yeah. I have found that I can win over those faculty through really just actually getting them into the tool and moving away from academic uses and more towards those everyday life problems. So in London, I was doing consulting on AI just last year, and I had a group of faculty that I was working with. One was a physical exercise, like human development and physical, training, athletic training kind of discipline. And so I said to her, I said, so what's going on in your life? Like, what's your big problem? And she's like, well, I don't know. What do you mean? And I said, well, like, what are you in your everyday life? Like, what are your personal goals? What are you trying to work to in your hobbies and stuff? She said, well, I'm thinking about running a marathon next year. I said, great. And why is that hard? And she was like, well, I had a baby, and also, like, I don't always have as much time in the day, and I got a new pair of shoes, but they're kind of hurting my feet. And I said, great, put all of that into GPT. And she said, right now, like, here? And I said, yeah, we'll put you up on the screen and we'll follow along. Like, we're not going to get too personal, but you'll be fine. So she did. She put in her thing and she said, here's what I want, and here's my goal, and here's my thing. And she hit enter, and it immediately started building her training plan, which is what the prompt was, build me a training plan. And she was actually, in front of everyone in the room, she was delighted. She was thrilled because she started saying things like, oh my gosh. And then as the group started having a discussion, she couldn't help herself. She was in the prompt again, adding questions and details and following up. And so you could see, like, in this setting of trying to do a kind of a consulting transformational experience, we had this person who was authentically learning, and we had kind of asked for her to volunteer. And so she was in front of everyone, but it was so authentic that while the discussion continued, she couldn't help but take the next step. And I think that witnessing that was useful to other people in the room, because they could see, like, oh, it's not about formality. It's not about, it's just about the human experience. Like getting from this tool answers to real questions, that's learning. And that is what convinced me that it is a cultural, it is truly a cultural experience. That if we treat this as technological innovation only and not cultural innovation, we will be slow. But as soon as we come together and start doing community experiences where people are saying, oh, what did you do? What did you ask it? What did it teach you? Oh, how fascinating. I wonder if I could use it in a similar way. That is when we're really going to see the early majority adopt, and then hopefully then the late majority come swiftly after.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I went to NYU for instructional technology for several years before I got pregnant and had to leave to get my grad degree. And I always thought I was going for instructional design, but really the program was called instructional technology. And one of the first classes, they said, see this pencil? This is technology. It didn't exist before, right? We were using chalkboard and the change that occurred there was that people could actually take their work away from the chalkboard, right? And they could have lots more because it was paper. So it was interesting for me to think about it like that. And so now I'm always fascinated by the facilitation of the technology and the benefits of it. And what you're saying, because I'm thinking about the future of our students. So our students are going to need to have a skill set that they didn't used to have. How do you think the university can prepare students for how to use these tools, whether it's ChatGPT, whether it's some other technology we haven't even thought about yet, you know, a brain implant? How do we set them on the right direction on how to use it for their lives past graduation and into their job or in their personal lives? Is there space for that in the university, or is that more of a soft skill?
I do actually think it's a soft skill and a hard skill, because there's a way to intuitively go about it where you get a pretty good result. And then there's a more structured way to go about it where you ensure a really good result. And so in terms of prompt engineering, and this is spoken about all the time, that it's you know, you get what you put into it, that a kind of a lame prompt gets kind of an okay answer. Kind of a brilliant prompt gets a brilliant answer. And that is a hard skill, right? There's frameworks of how to write really effective prompts. And the ones that I find to be most helpful are the ones that start with the prompter's identity and the GPT's identity. So a really good prompt might read out something like, I am an associate provost of a large online institution. You are my administrative coach, and you're going to help me over the next 5 or 10 minutes to resolve a personnel issue that has arisen. And so what I'd like to do is introduce you to the problem and the cast of characters, and then have you draw on literature. And this is the Socratic approach, right? Where I'm going to now introduce a few words, maybe authors Jim Collins, or I might say, you know, I want you to rely on Rogerian theories of human development, where I'm going to seed it with the kinds of words that are going to help it give me the kinds of answers that I'm used to utilizing. And now I'm going to present the problem, present the framework in the Socratic way. I've given it an identity and me an identity. And then also what my motivations are, right? I want to resolve this personnel issue in a way that's empowering and swift, that gets ahead of it kind of spreading, but also acknowledges that, you know, people need a chance to grow. That's why I'm throwing in the word Rogerian, right? Rogerian theories of human development are that people are in process and you need to give them time. And that was the background of my training in the management, was people are in process. And then when you hit enter now, because you've done a very thoughtful hard skills prompt, instead of just a soft skills, oh, I need help with a personnel issue at work. Now you get a very thoughtful, engaging response that you can dialogue with. And where I find most of the usefulness of GPT is not in the initial answer, but in the dialogue that flows over many exchanges, right? So it's not just the first response, because I am not trying to produce text on a page. And this is what we have to teach our students, that if you are trying to produce text on a page, you are doing it wrong. Because the point of using GPT should be to produce knowledge and transformation within the learner, within you. And so when I build a prompt correctly, or teach students how to build a prompt correctly and thoughtfully, it produces the kind of response that calls for dialogue. It calls for follow-up, calls for further engagement. And it is the further engagement that deepens the transformation. And this is where I do think the hard skills of prompt engineering and of really understanding as a learner some of the metacognitive experiences that you're having in terms of critical inquiry, cognitive closure, motivation, these kinds of things, growth mindset, that all of those things really roll together to say that there is a good way of helping students to figure this stuff out. And there's an awful way, which is just saying, well, I'm sure they'll figure it out. They won't.
Honestly, if we could put a period, I mean, I would love, really, I think we've covered a lot. And I really feel like that tied it beautifully together. So I would love if you had any further thoughts before we close it out. Otherwise, I think we've spent a wonderful 45 minutes discussing some pretty relevant topics. And I want to thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks so much. I think the final thought is this: we are in a messy middle. And there are many administrators who wish that the stability of this period would emerge quickly, and I don't believe that it will. A cultural shift takes time. I'm reminded cars were first introduced in the 1880s or something like this, the early first cars. And it wasn't until like the 1920s that you actually developed like road laws, traffic laws. So there was some 30, 40 years where cars were out on the roads, zooming around, having problems, creating problems, but not being regulated because there was no cultural understanding of what the regulation should be. I do think that we're in this messy middle period where GPT has come out. Could it be more thoroughly regulated? Yes, both at the national level and at organizational levels. But it is the usage and experimentation. It is the zooming around, so to speak, that will lead us to know where the strengths are, where the limitations are, what the risks are. And I do think that this conversation is really about the early impressions that we have about the potential of these tools, if they're to be used wisely, and the pitfalls also, but kind of whatever else we do, let's not pass on the opportunity to dive in, to experiment, and to kind of culturally, as a community of practitioners, come to an awareness of how this is really going to help our students, if used correctly, to transform their lives for the economy that is emerging. And that's truly, I think, the promise and the potential of these tools, if we can find it.
Well, thank you so much, Mitch. It was really great talking to you. Anybody who wants to check out the additional podcasts, we'll be linking to them as well. So thanks so much, Mitch.
Thank you, Shannon.